It's I've been here for a few days. It's been very nice to be with the devotees here. It's very much a place that reminds us me of where I'm from. I'm from Copenhagen. And actually, the Sunday program that you're having here is exactly the same Sunday program that we have in Copenhagen. We start at 3 o'clock, Bhajan for 45 minutes, lecture for 45 minutes, Kirtan, Prasadam, exactly the same. And this is probably one of the wonderful things about this Krishna consciousness movement. You can go anywhere in the world and you just drop in and you're home. So that's, you know, Srila Prabhupada's mercy has created such a wonderful society. Do we chant Jai Radha Madhava first, isn't that?
Yes.
Yeah. Could someone get me a table to put in front here, please? And Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. Kunjabi Hari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari Gopi Janna Vallabha Girivada Dadi Jaya Gopi Janna Vallabha Girivada Dadi Yashoda Nandana Braja Janna Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Braja Janna Ranjana Yamuna Chira Vana Chadi Yamuna Chira Vana Chadi Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari Gopi Janna Vallabha Girivada Dadi Jaya Gopi Janna Vallabha Girivada Dadi Yashoda Nandana Braja Janna Ranjana Yashoda Nandana Braja Janna Ranjana Yamuna Chira Vana Chadi Yamuna Chira Vana Chadi Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Bihari. 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 Oh, Premananda, Hari Hari Om. So, I have prepared a small presentation here for you called Life Comes from Life Revisited, because I was involved in writing a book about a Krishna conscious perspective on Darwin and evolution. And I'll try to give you like a gist of the what is in the book and the Krishna conscious perspective on this very important topic. And I call it Life Comes from Life Revisited. Life Comes from Life, of course, refers to a series of conversations that Srila Prabhupada had, which came out as a book. I believe you have that in Slovenian also. Life Comes from Life, very good book. Where Prabhupada argues that life always comes from life. We've never seen life comes from matter. Ultimately, he argues very simply for the existence of God with a direct but simple arguments. Because here, the motive behind this, can everyone see the screen? So here, Srila Prabhupada, he writes, a person who always desires to serve Krishna is interested in ways to convince people that there is a Supreme Personality of Godhead and that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is Krishna. That is his ambition. So anyone who comes to the Hare Krishna temple will, of course, be exposed to devotees trying to convince him that Krishna is God. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is, and of course, if you don't like to hear that, then don't come to a Hare Krishna temple, because this is what this is what we're telling people. But Prabhupada's point here is also obvious, that how can we convince anyone that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead if a person thinks in the first place there's no God to begin with? So then it doesn't make sense that Krishna should be God, because God doesn't exist anyway. So also devotees have to have arguments for why we should accept the existence of a God at all. And I know for myself that was very, very relevant, because I came from an atheistic background. I was atheist and very convinced about that for many, many years. And well, a couple of years before I got in touch with devotees and Srila Prabhupada's teachings, I realized actually God must exist. And why did I realize that? I'm not quite sure, but some logical reasons were there, and also some personal experiences convinced me that actually God must be there. And then I got in touch with Krishna consciousness a couple of years later. I never had the desire to join a religious society, actually. That was never my ambition. But when I got in touch with Krishna consciousness, it was so attractive and so right, correct, I couldn't help myself. I had to join. I had no choice. Well, and one thing that was attractive was also the rational approach, which you know, convinced me. I already was convinced God was existing, but now with Prabhupada's teaching, I got convinced 108% that God actually does exist. And I found it very, very important always to have this foundation to be, you know, scientifically, rationally convinced from moment to moment that God is there, and then, you know, call out to Krishna, try to serve Krishna from there. So, yeah, so this, you know, also because I have some science background, so this whole approach has always been very relevant for me. And Prabhupada put great emphasis on this. And especially, he was very intent on that we, you know, we confront the ideas from Charles Darwin and the modern theories of evolution. Here is a quote from Prabhupada: because they're standing on a wrong theory, all their calculations are wrong, and people are suffering. The rascal Darwin's theory, this foolish theory, wrong conception of life. So we have to challenge, protest, and defeat. This will be our work. Otherwise, it will be misleading this society. We have to stop this misleading. Prabhupada is very emphatic here and using very strong language. Similarly here, he says, scientists and people after this so-called scientist Darwin, we want to stop this misleading. This, that is our duty. So one might ask, why is Prabhupada so angry at Darwin? There are so many scientists he could be angry at, but why particularly at Darwin? Is it because Darwin was British and Prabhupada is Indian, he didn't like British people or something like that? Phobia, maybe. No, Prabhupada was right on, because what Darwin did was very, very dramatic. Here's a scientist called Francisco Ayala, you know, contemporary scientist, describes it exactly what Darwin he did. Darwin's greatest accomplishment was to show that the complex order and function in living creatures can't be explained as a result of a natural process or natural selection without having referred to a creator or some other external factor. So actually what Darwin he did was he actually pushed God out of the world of science, which was not the case before. Many have the idea that scientists or science have always had a conflict with religion and vice versa. But that's simply not correct. It only came after the time of Darwin. Before Darwin's time, scientists, you know, because they're rational people, they could see that nature in general and also special life is simply too complex to be explained by something that has just come about on its own through material processes. And I mean, that was just standard, you know, among scientists. But Darwin, he changed that. I have here, just to illustrate that, one quote here from Newton. I think everyone also knows Newton. And he wrote in his most important scientific book, "This most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." And that was in the middle of a book packed with mathematical formulas and gravity and planetary motions and so on. Then he writes that. And that wasn't considered, you know, outside of science. Scientists were thinking like that. But Darwin changed that. In 1859, he published his most famous book on the origin of species by means of natural selection, where he claims that he could explain life simply by some material process without having to refer to anything non-material behind life. He claimed that life could arise on its own on the early Earth and simply evolve on its own over millions and millions and hundreds of millions of years without any interference of any higher intelligence. And somehow or another, his idea caught on. And after, you know, just a few years, you couldn't really be accepted in the scientific community if you didn't accept the idea of natural evolution, Darwin's natural evolution. And it had great implications for the rest of the world and the rest, you know, rest of mankind, actually. Atheism has spread to the last degree because of Darwin's ideas, actually. And so Professor Ayala, he is really correct when he says this was Darwin's accomplishment. He pushed God out of science. And nowadays has come to that point that some think that you cannot even, in a scientific context, discuss whether God is there or God is necessary for explaining life or nature. Of course, that's a funny proposal, because this is precisely what Darwin does. Darwin does discuss God and claiming that he's not necessary. But if you can do that in a scientific context, you could also similarly argue scientifically that maybe God is necessary to explain life and nature. Darwin does, you know, God is included in Darwin's discussions just negatively. But then it should also be possible to, you know, argue positively for God's existence if scientific observations support that. But that was definitely Darwin. He pushed God out of the scientific discussion. And of course, this statement here by this Professor Ayala is not completely correct. He writes here that Darwin showed how the complex order and function of living creatures can be explained as a result of a natural process. But actually, that's not, Darwin did not really show that. He argued that, and many got convinced by his arguments, but literally speaking, he did not show it, because many are not aware of that, including many scientists. But Darwin's theory, original theory that he proposed in his Origin of Species, was actually tested in the years that followed, and it was shown to be wrong. And those who are, you can say, believers of evolution nowadays are not really Darwinist in the strict sense of term. They have a new theory which is called Neo-Darwinism, which is a different theory, somewhat different theory. And therefore, to say that Darwin showed that you could explain life in that way is actually not correct. That is not correct. And that's, you know, that's important to have in mind. Just to give you a little idea what the distinction is. Darwin had the idea that species can change unlimitedly, and that turns out to be wrong. He also had the idea that external influences, a use of organs, can create new genetic material and acquired traits are inherited. Maybe that's, you know, I have to explain a little what that means. But Darwin had the idea that if you breed on animals, for example, breeding on dogs can give us all kinds of very large dogs and tiny dogs, and dogs of all kinds of colors and furs and sounds and smells and so on. And so Darwin's idea, if you keep on breeding and breeding and breeding, at one point you'll get new species, not just different varieties of dogs, but you'll get completely new species of animals. But that's wrong, and that was clearly shown. That does not happen. And we can use the example of dogs. They're very, very different, apparently, you know, but they're still dogs. And nothing, and have not, never become anything but dogs. And breeding does not create new species. It just creates variety within one species. So Darwin was wrong there. And then he was wrong on this point that changes caused to the organism can be passed on to the next generation. This idea was important for him because Darwin had to explain how new features arise in a species. Of course, natural selection is often seen as a code process or a main process in his evolution, but that's not really true, because if selection only removes something, but it doesn't add something to a species. So the real question is, where do new features come from? And Darwin's proposal was that organisms can be changed here and now, and these changes can be passed on to the next generation. And that's wrong. It's not that if I for example, go to some kind of intense exercise, bodybuilding, and I become big and strong with big muscles, and then I'll have children with bigger muscles. That doesn't happen. Or I often give another very interesting example. In some cultures in the world, women, they make themselves even more beautiful by, for example, enlarging their ears and their lips by hanging heavy weights in their ears and enlarging their lips. And but still, girls in those countries are born like girls everywhere else. That doesn't change them. Or if we move to a very sunny and warm place, and we become brown and suntanned and like that, that doesn't mean our children are born with more darker skin. If we are us who are, very light skinned, we still will get children who are very light skinned. So this idea was wrong. These two ideas were wrong. So they were the, therefore, Darwin's original theory was not, could not be accepted, and it was actually rejected. And another theory, Neo-Darwinism, has arisen, which is the idea instead that genetic mutations create new genes, which ultimately make a rise to new species and otherwise stable species. Here you see the key word is mutations. Something that Darwin spoke about mutations, but that's not a word that existed when Darwin was writing. It's a later word. Mutations were discovered when, well, first it was discovered that actually species are very stable and constant, contrary to what Darwin had hoped for, especially by Gregor Mendel's work. If we are aware of Gregor Mendel, Austrian monk who was making research on pea flowers and like that, he showed that species actually are very, very constant. But then it was discovered that sometimes there's a change, and they were called freaks of nature, and later on they were called mutations. And later on in the 20th century, in the 1950s, it was discovered that mutations, they are copying mistakes on the DNA. When the DNA copies itself during cell division, then sometimes there's this mistake in this copying, and that's a mutation. And these mutations, they are the basis in Neo-Darwinism for what generates new genetic material. So it's a different, that's a different theory. So, and that's kind of the standard theory, and has been the standard theory for practically a century or something like that. Now, this does not mean that actually this mutational theory is really solidly established. There are scientists who have great doubts that this Neo-Darwinian theory is also incomplete and lacking and cannot explain the complexity of life. And there are many, many arguments regarding that. I'll give you one argument. Here, this is malarial parasites in different stages. And malaria, is a disease that is spread in the tropics by this parasite. A person gets contaminated or infected by a parasite. A mosquito, brings a parasite from another diseased person, and then this parasite starts dividing and multiplying in the person, and ultimately a person has millions and billions of parasites in his bloodstream and becomes very sick and sometimes dies from malaria. So malaria parasites are interesting because there have been actually so many malaria parasites for the last 10,000 years. Their numbers is staggering. Malaria is only a tropical disease, and one can ask, how is that? Why is that? And the reason is that these parasites, they cannot tolerate temperatures below 16.5 degrees centigrade. If they, you know, if temperature goes below that, they can no longer multiply and they die out. So then one could question, you know, that as so many individuals and generations of malarial parasites, actually there have been more malarial parasites for the last 10,000 years than there have been mammals for the last 100 million years. And we know that, you know, according to evolutionary theory, all mammals, including, you know, all the whales and the elephants and the humans and the monkeys and the bats and, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of different mammals, are supposed to have arisen from one original mammal, a small kind of a rat-like creature, through genetic mutations. So how is it that these malaria parasites, by the same process of mutations, cannot develop tolerance just to a few, you know, a lower temperature? There's something wrong there. But it turns out that if parasites should develop resistance to lower temperatures, they would more mutations would happen have to happen simultaneously. That is likely to ever happen, even with this amazing number of parasites that are always there. And that also puts a big question mark on this idea that much greater variety arose in a less population of mammals through the same process of mutations. So, I mean, there are many arguments like that. And theory has really a hard time explaining many of these problems. One problem also with the whole theory of evolution, which I'm going to mention here, Darwin recognized that. I just want to bring up the point of fossils also, because many think at least evolution is established by the presence of fossils. Darwin, however, did not think so. Here is a quote from Darwin himself. He writes here, "The number of intermediate varieties which have formerly existed must be truly enormous. Why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory." Darwin says the fossils are the most obvious and serious objection against his theory, because you only find fully developed species, but you don't find intermediate in the fossil record. You find cats, you find dogs, but you don't find a common ancestor or a gradual evolution of one strain of this common ancestor that becomes more dog-like and another strain that becomes more cat-like. You don't find that in the case of cats and dogs. You don't find it anywhere. Darwin, at least not at Darwin's time, and that is a problem of the missing links in relation to Darwin's theory. So Darwin saw this as an objection to his theory. He was hoping the future would reveal these missing intermediate forms, but it has not happened. Here is a quote from a professor from 1954, where he wrote, "The fossil material is now so complete that the lack of transitional series cannot be explained as due to the scarcity of material. The deficiencies are real. They will never be filled." And if we wind another 50 years ahead, up to our time, 2008, another scientist, expert in the field, wrote here, Niels Eldredge wrote here, "Patterns in evolutionary history characteristically repeat themselves, regardless of position in time, place, or clade, leaving no trace of intermediates." So fossils are a problem for Darwin's theory, or new Darwinian theory. And actually, you know, I could go on and just give you, you know, problem after problem after problem. It's really not a strong theory that seems to be able to explain very much, or is really backed very much by evidence. The problems are so pronounced. You can even go on the internet And there you can find this statement. There's a website called descentfromdarwin.org. There's a statement there. We are skeptical of claims for the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. Careful examination of the evidence for Darwinian theory should be encouraged. This statement is signed now by 1,000 scientists, and you can also, if you are a scientist, and you minimum have a PhD in physics, mathematics, biology, biochemistry, geology, you know, one of the hard sciences, you can also put your name on. But you have to be a professional scientist to put your name on. So 1,000 scientists have put their names on this statement that actually we are not convinced about this theory. There should be more research to establish what is actually, you know, what the case actually is. And the problems are so many that actually in 2008 in Vienna, the Konrad Lorenz Institute invited 16 of the world's leading biologists to come and discuss the problems, because we have problems with our theory. The conference was called Toward an Extended Evolutionary Synthesis, and the organizers explained themselves in the invitation thus: not only we have witnessed the molecular revolution from the discovery of the structure of DNA to the genomic era, we are also grappling with the increasing feeling that we just don't have the theoretical and analytical tools necessary to make sense of the bewildering diversity and complexity of living organisms. In other words, this sentence pulled out from the quote there, we just don't have the theoretical tools necessary to make sense of the complexity of living organisms. They're admitting we don't have a theory. We thought, but didn't you have Darwin's theory? So, but we don't have a theory that can explain the complexity of living organisms. This is especially in the light of now about 50, 60 years research into molecular biology and the nature of cells and how cells they work. Cells are, of course, the foundation of all living organisms, and a cell is the most simple life that can exist independently. Below cells, you don't have life. So cells are crucial, and life must have started with the first cell. Darwin thought a cell was something very simple, because at his time the microscopes were not very powerful, and he could just see some round glob of some, you know, some not nothing detailed. So he thought, That's not going to be very hard to explain. But science has discovered something else. Inside the world of the cell is a universe on its own, a more complex world that exists, that you don't find any complex world like that anywhere else in the universe. They say it's the most complex thing in existence. Inside one cell, more things are going on than in the entire city of Ljubljana going on at the same time. Millions of processes are going on. There are all kinds of nano robots. There are processes. It's even there's even digital technology inside cells. It has its own computer. That's a problem. You know, what are cells? You know, and how did they come up, arise in the first place on this planet? I'm going to give you a quick, you know, 3 minutes video clip with some scientists discussing that, and followed by an animation of what goes on inside a cell, just, you know, so we can appreciate the magnitude of the problem for explaining, you know, the complexity of cells. Let's see.
No matter how life began, on the backs of crystals or in the test tube of some intelligent designer, everyone agrees that it started with a single cell. But what is a cell? Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Darwin wrote The Origin of Species in 1859, published it in 1859. He had an idea of the cell as being quite simple, correct?
Yeah, everybody did.
Yeah, okay. If he thought of the cell as being a Buick, what is the cell now in terms of its complexity by comparison?
A galaxy.
If Darwin thought a cell was, say, a mud hut, what do we now know that a cell is?
More complicated than a Saturn V.
So what is in a cell, as far as we know now?
a world that Darwin never could have imagined.
I needed someone who could give me a glimpse into this world. So we went to molecular biologist Doug Axe.
Think of a cell as being a nanofactory, a factory where, on a very small scale, digital instructions are being used to make the components of the factory. Here we have the famous DNA double helix. You can see the two helical strands that are intertwined and wind around each other on the outside of the molecule. This is the material that stores all of our genetic information. In higher life forms, this will be the equivalent of something like a gigabyte of information stored in the molecules that form the individual chromosomes, all packed within the nucleus, which is a tiny fraction of the entire cell size. So what does DNA do? Well, the information in DNA ends up providing the information for sequencing amino acids to make proteins. We have information in a one-dimensional form that provides the information for a three-dimensional form.
Systems within the cell that go well beyond Darwinian evolution? Some type of cellular technology that drives adaptation, replication, quality control, and repair? What if these new mechanisms have massive design implications? Well, I say, so be it.
So the discovery of this complexity is actually, that's the main reason why in the organized Conrad Lorenz stated this: we just don't have the theoretical tools necessary to make sense of the complexity of living organisms. There's no theory that can explain how this complexity arose in the first place. You may remember Prabhupada, he states in Life Come From Life back in 1973, the scientists must admit that they still do not know the origin of life. The claim that they will soon prove a chemical origin of life is something like paying someone with a post-dated check. And Prabhupada was, you know, it was true in 1973. It's true to this day. They have no theory that can explain the origin of life. And just give one example. This is already a 20-year-old quote, but it's still 100% true as when it was spoken in 98. One scientist said, "Today, as we leave the 20th century, we still face the biggest unsolved problem that we had when we entered the 20th century. How did life originate on Earth?" In other words, there's not really any theory of evolution as such. If you talk science, there's a story. Many believe it. It's the main creation story in our modern world, basically. But there's no scientific theory of evolution as such that can be tested or verified, anything like that. Therefore, we say, and this is Sataputta. Many of you may know Sataputta was a scientist and disciple of Prabhupada. He stated here in a lecture in 1976 in the presence of Srila Prabhupada, actually discussing this molecular complexity that we just saw. "We'd like to argue that the chance of molecular forces theory won't explain things like this, but to say that there is an intelligent designer would be a sensible explanation." We'd like to argue there is an intelligent designer behind nature. This is actually our you know, goal as Krishna conscious scientists. Or I'd say even more than that, we really want to establish this point from the Bhagavad Gita, you know, as you can say, our understanding of biology. It's Krishna stating, Iswara Savabhutanam Riddhisya Junatistati Brahmayan Savabhutani Yantra Rudani Mayaya. The Supreme Lord is situated within everyone's heart, O Arjuna, and is directing the wanderings of all living entities who are seated as on a machine made of the material energy. In other words, we want to establish that there's not only the body or the machine of the body, but there's also a conscious being, you know, we can call it the soul, or a conscious living entity sitting on the machine, and then there is a superior conscious, a higher consciousness, who is there directing both the workings of the machine and the individual living beings. There are three things in nature, not just matter. So, Hare Krishna, I think there's... We have 1.5 minutes if someone has a question on this. If you're interested, I mean, I brought some copies of our book. You can take one if you want afterwards, or like that, where we can read all about this in details. Any questions?
So when I listened to like evolutionary theory for the first time, I really had I really saw like similarities between this theory and like the theory, let's say, of probability in aspect of explaining very complex phenomena in like, let's say, mean, like in the average. So like I thought that in the aspect of explaining very complex phenomena with like simple solution, I really see similarities between them. And I would just like to ask you, what is like your view on the probability theory, so on distributions that are trying to explain, like quantum mechanics, for example, which is completely probability-based theory.
Yeah, probabilities are very bad for evolutionary theory, because I need 5 minutes for that, but I don't think we have time for that, do we? Okay, I can give you a probability calculation that I've already made. Yeah, it's kind of, you know, argument that if there's just enough time, then anything can happen by chance and development, and it makes everything becomes probable when there's enough time. So in one sense, that's not completely true, because there is what you can call a universal probability bound. This universe is limited. It's we only have something like 14 billion years. There are only so many atoms in the universe, and there are only so many things that can happen inside a universe per every second. So that gives you a look here. There are 10 to the 80th elementary particles in the known universe, you know, 10 with 80 zeros after. There are, can maximum be 10 to the 45th events per second in a particle. That is limited by the speed of light. And there has been less than 10 to the 18th seconds in, or 14.5 billion years since the Big Bang. That's kind of standard, you know, science theory. You can follow? Yeah, okay. That gives the maximum number of events to have ever happened in the known universe to be 10 to the, you know, 147 zeros after. That means, just to round up, that any events with probability less than 10 to the minus 150th is unlikely to have ever happened. So then let's look at life, and let's look at one very essential feature about life is proteins. Proteins are molecules made of, a protein is a long chain put together of molecules called amino acids. There are 20 amino acids relevant in living organisms. And if you have a chain of, say, like 200 amino acids long, then that means for each, you know, at each place there are 20 possibilities for you can choose one amino acid there. So that means you have 20 raised to the 200th, or that gives about approximately 10 to 260th, one followed by 260 zeros. So that means that, you know, this is a much bigger number than universal probability bound. So even if one protein and in a cell, the most simple cell needs 200 proteins to function, but just the chance for one protein change to arise by chance, even if you had all the events in the universe ever happened, just trying to make put this protein chain together, you wouldn't even get a specific, you know, a required protein chain. And therefore, you know, here's a quote from one scientist. There are indeed a lot of stars, at least 10 billion billion in the observable universe, but this number, gigantic as it may appear to us, is nevertheless trivially small compared with the gigantic odds against a random assembly of even a single protein molecule. So, I mean, we can get into more details, and I mean, if we had a, you know, it could be discussed this, but you get an idea. The probabilities are still, you know, impossible to overcome by, you know, even though you have millions and millions of years. It's okay? Hi, Krishna. I think we need some, you know, Kirtan, isn't it?
Can you just expand for 6 o'clock? What will be the topic from 6 to 7?
I was asked to, because I've been involved with translating and editing Srila Prabhupada's books quite a lot in the Danish language and in general with editing. And there seems to be some confusion nowadays by, you know, what goes on BBT with editing Prabhupada's books and so on. So I was asked to give a presentation about editing in Prabhupada's books and the justification for the editing that goes on and so on. So that will be something, you know, it'll be, I mean, it's supposed to be interesting. We'll be looking a lot at Bhagavad Gita and actually at Prabhupada's original manuscripts, what Prabhupada he was writing, and a lot of what Prabhupada said about editing and publishing of his books. And that will be 6 o'clock?
6 o'clock in the classroom after.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. You are wonderful devotees and a wonderful audience. Hare Krishna.